You ain't heard about Moto Casino? Moto has real Vegas slots. Any game you can find on the floor in Vegas, you can play it on Moto. I like my slots hot. Moto's free to play, like food stamps. In line at the grocery store, at a funeral, in traffic. Keep your eyes on the road. Hop on Moto Casino. Moto Casino got jackpots that are bigger than my belly. Moto, America's hottest free-to-play social casino.
Download the Moto Casino app today.
Moto Casino is a social casino. Void where prohibited. No purchase necessary. Visit Moto.us for more details.
Moto Casino.
You're listening to a podcast right now, driving, working out, walking the dog. If you're into podcasts, chances are you have something to say too. With RSS.com, starting your own podcast is free and easy. Upload an episode and we distribute it to Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Amazon Music, and more. Track your listeners, see where they're from, and start earning from ads just like this. If you've been thinking about starting a podcast, this is your sign. Start your new podcast for free today at RSS.com.
Hello and welcome to the Full of Beans podcast, hosted by myself, Hannah Hickenbotham. Throughout these podcast episodes, we will speak to a range of individuals about their experience of eating disorders, with the aim of increasing awareness and understanding, whilst reducing stigma and isolation. Please note that the topics discussed in this podcast may be triggering for some individuals, so tread lightly, check in with yourself, and reflect on these conversations. Today I'm joined by Dr. Helen Startup and Dr. Nikki Gilbert. Helen is a teacher and trainer of schema therapy at the Schema Therapy School UK and provides workshops. She has also co-authored a schema therapy book and has experience of working in both the NHS and private sector as a consultant psychologist in eating disorders. Nikki is a consultant clinical psychologist who works as a clinical supervisor and provides eating disorder therapy. Nikki has personal experience of receiving schema therapy, which commenced her love of schema therapy. Helen and Nikki join me today to discuss the methods behind schema therapy, how it works from both a clinical perspective and personal perspective. Hello, Helen and Nikki.
Hi, Hannah. Thanks so much for inviting us. It's good to be
here. It's really exciting. It's lovely to have two people to chat to as well. It's always so nice, the more faces. I don't know how many I've done with two people now, but it's always really exciting to get loads of different viewpoints on different things. So thank you both for joining me.
Thank you.
Yeah, it's a pleasure. It's lovely to have a little gang.
And lovely to have you back, Nikki.
I know. I liked it so much.
I was absolutely number one fan. So obviously, like, you're both here to talk about schema therapy today. And for some listeners, schema therapy might be a completely brand new area of therapy, or for some, it might be something they've heard of before. So I guess if we were to set the scene, would you mind giving us a bit of an overview of what schema therapy is?
Yeah, sure. I'll do my best. It's always sort of remarkably tricky putting these things into few words. But so schema therapy is a psychological therapy, and it's based on an integrative model of the self. And what we kind of mean by that is that it's been influenced by many kind of core theories, really. And many of these have been around for a very long time. And kind of most psychological therapies are sort of based on them one way or another. Perhaps the main influences that really stand out to me are the attachment literature and our knowledge there, our understanding really that relationships are absolutely core, and that the relationships that we had earlier in life form the foundations for what we expect in our relationships as adults. But also other ways of thinking. So, for example, emotion-focused therapy has contributed heavily. So this is the idea that, you know, it's not sufficient really just to get something at a head level or even to change behaviorally, that actually a kind of important depth to healing comes from shifts that are at an emotional level. And another, I think, core and really significant influence is a sort of gestalt way of seeing the self as being made up of part selves. And I love this way of viewing things, and we're all made up of part selves. It enables us, I don't know if you ever have that sort of sense of, you know, one part of yourself being in the driving seat and other parts of the self maybe not being so available. And I find it a really sort of lovely way of helping people to understand how, you know, sometimes one of the goals of working is simply to get the self to communicate better with different sides of the self and to bolster different parts of the self. So You know, skin therapy was developed by Jeffrey Young. It's in its full form. It can be quite a long-term therapy, so 18 months or longer. But it's also briefer models are being developed all the time. And, you know, it's been influenced by many different models, as I say. And in terms of the kind of core change processes, really, I suppose I would say it's that the therapeutic relationship's at the heart. It's not just important, but it's an actual vehicle by which people get well. There's a shared formulation. So it's not just an understanding that's in the therapist's head or is inferred. It's collaboratively devised. It's a coming together of ideas and it's mapped out. And that many of the ways of working are based on things like imagery techniques, things like chair work, emotion-focused techniques as a route into trying to support people. And the very final thing that I really do love about schema therapy and want to mention is the concept of the healthy adult, which I think is so sort of significant in so far as, you know, we spend a lot of time thinking in mental health about parts of us, and we all have them, that don't work optimally to help us get our needs met, and about change and the process of change. But one of the things about the healthy adult is about bolstering a side to ourselves that's got our back, that's on our sides, that can look on at the rest of us and can help us out. And we spend a lot of time in schema therapy helping people to have a real resilience and a strength in this side that we think of as a bit of an organizer or as a healthy adult. So, that's my kind of sort of brief summary, really, of what stands out in schema therapy for me.
And yeah. That healthy adult side is one of my favourite bits of the model as well. And I think it's something I always have in mind now, like through even when I'm not delivering schema therapy, if I'm delivering any other therapy, I think about it as a lovely kind of mode and a nice sense of believing that we've all got that healthy adult part. It might be really depleted at different points. It might have been quite flattened and maybe a bit missing. And certainly when I have been at my most depleted point, my healthy adult, I don't know where it went, but it wasn't quite as present. And then the therapy experience was about discovering it and strengthening it. And I think I've got some really powerful memories of my person I was working with doing that with me. I think she said at one point, my little vulnerable part, so when we talk about part of self, she's like, oh, little Nikki is really lucky because she's got like you as her healthy adult. And I'll never forget the power of that for me. I think she said it was just the right point in my journey, just the right moment. But it was such a gift, and I think it's a real gift for me now as a clinician, because I think about how that was delivered, and I think carefully for everyone I work with about where's their healthy adult at, you know, how do we need to build it. It keeps me really humble as a clinician too, because I find you can step into over responsibility. Like maybe when I look back at being more junior in my career, kind of getting a little bit sort of lost, and maybe kind of ego-wise, maybe a little bit kind of built up by fixing and rescuing somebody, when actually it might be more complex and more need more nuance and thought. But actually, if you can empower them, be alongside them, give them skills and fuel them up to fix themselves, you're giving your skills away. You're generating more and more of a healthy adult in them. That's really what our job's about as clinicians, certainly like at least just for schema therapy. It's always in my mind when I'm delivering therapy, and hopefully I try and think about it always in my mind as a human as well.
Yeah, it's so hope inducing, isn't it, insofar as, you know, whenever any of us have dark times, it's really hard to be in touch with that healthy adult side. But sometimes being able to remember that it's in there, even though we may not feel completely in touch with it in that moment, can, you know, be enough to kind of to get through, really, to know that it's lingering there somewhere for us.
Yeah, I really like the idea of the healthy adult, and it's something that, you know, in my own therapy as well, that has been brought up quite a lot in terms of I don't know whether this is something that's very common in eating disorders. You guys can tell me, but sort of when we're thinking about parts, maybe the childlike part being a lot more dominant for me anyway, and not really being able to connect to that healthy adult part. But I really liked what you were saying, Nikki, and it made me feel as though almost you were using your own healthy adult to connect with your clients and say, okay, like, you know, you're maybe displaying a you know, your inner child right now, I've got my healthy adult. And rather than me kind of just coming and protecting you as I would to a child, I'm trying to help you to bring out that sort of your healthy adult as well. Mm-hmm. And I think, like you say, we've all got one. It just mm-hmm. can often feel quite lost. Yeah. So how, when you're doing the schema therapy, is it, you know, we've spoken about the healthy adult. Mm-hmm. Are there other parts that you try and bring up as well? Or is it kind of mainly focusing on that healthy adult?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, we it's a very kind of normalizing model insofar as, you know, we all have similar versions of certain parts of self. And what we talk about in schema therapy is, as you're saying, Hannah, that we all have a kind of vulnerable part that may be sort of younger in feel, insofar as, you know, at the time of kind of development, it maybe housed many of our very early feelings. And it often sort of contains feelings that, you know, we don't wear on our sleeves all the time. You know, there may be the feelings of sadness, or they may be linked to schema, such as feeling quite unsafe or quite abandoned. But they're those really sort of core feeling states that sometimes go along with other, you know, bodily experiences, images, memories. But as you say, we call that the vulnerable child. And really then sort of beyond that, we all have what we think in terms of as coping modes, which are really just all of our very best attempts to, you know, manage what's coming our way, to manage the pain of our vulnerability. And in, you know, eating disorders, for example, we may have a part of the self that needs to cut off from things, like we might call it a detached protector or the wall or something like that, which is the side of the self which tries to push down feelings that are painful. We may also have another part of the self that we describe as quite overcompensatory, where you try to get on top of the difficult feelings. You try to be almost as opposite as some of the schemas underlying it. So say, for example, you had a lingering sense or a worry about being good enough. You may overcompensate by being in quite a kind of perfectionistic mode, or quite a sort of energetic, full-on busy type mode. So those are two kind of core modes that we think about in eating disorders. And there are many, many other modes. You know, another one is, we call it a kind of sort of like a bit of a subjugating mode. And that's where we push our own feelings down and we turn our attention to the needs of other people. And often, you know, individuals can be really acutely aware of the sensitivities of others and go very long ways to meeting them, but it can sometimes tip into being at the expense of one's own needs. And then I guess the other part of the self, and we all have it, I'm certainly very aware of my own, is a form of inner critic that kind of just can be on a continuum from jabbering away and saying, you know, quite critical things to, you know, some people endure critics that are extremely harsh and condemning. And, you know, obviously the emotional impact of being on the receiving end of that is extremely great. And that's what necessitates these coping modes to act as a buffer. And then we think of the healthy adult as being this sort of overarching, sort of, can think of it as like the conductor of the orchestra or the driver of the bus, but the part of ourselves that kind of organizes. And like my healthy adult might say something like, you know, there you go again, Helen, criticizing yourself, cut yourself some slack, give yourself a break. And that has an effect on my vulnerable child and soothes it and calms it. So that's a sort of an example of mode interaction there, which is the sort of thing that we're encouraging. But there are, you know, there are different varieties of modes, but those are some of the core ones, parts of the south, or modes, as we call them.
So when you're, because I mean, those modes, I can relate to all of those, and have seen, you know, I'm sure regardless of whether somebody has an eating disorder or not, they might have those modes, but they feel definitely really prominent in an eating disorder. So when you're, I think one thing that I found interesting, sort of from speaking to a range of different people about different therapeutic modes, is you mentioned it at the start, it's sort of going deep rather than I think, you know, traditionally we might look at
You're listening to a podcast right now. Driving, working out, walking the dog. If you're into podcasts, chances are you have something to say too. With RSS.com, starting your own is free and easy. Upload an episode and we distribute it to Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Amazon Music, and hundreds more. Track your listeners, see where they're from, and start earning from ads like this. Even with just 10 listeners a month. If you've been thinking about starting a podcast, this is your sign. Start free at rss.com.
You're listening to a podcast right now. Driving, working out, walking the dog. If you're into podcasts, chances are you have something to say too. With rss.com, starting your own podcast is free and easy. Upload an episode and we distribute it to Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Amazon Music, and more. Track your listeners, see where they're from, and start earning from ads just like this. If you've been thinking about starting a podcast, this is your sign. Start your new podcast for free today at rss.com.
Eating disorder behaviors, but actually it feels like therapy itself within eating disorders is moving towards going underneath and, you know, really looking at, you know, why do I have these behaviors? What are they serving me? And all of these different modes.
Yeah.
So when we're looking at working, well, when you're looking at working with your clients, is it about creating that healthy adult on a whole, and kind of looking at those different modes in terms of eating disorder behaviours, or do you kind of do it on a broad perspective to contribute to a healthier adult for them fully?
Yeah, so I suppose there's a few stages in a way to how we would work, and you're absolutely right that we all have modes. We could map any one of us, and we would all sort of fit into a sort of slight variance of the same kind of things, really. But I think that you know, the first stage in many ways is to build awareness. So, and it's amazing, I think, how helpful it is to become aware of our mode relationships, because modes aren't static. We don't sort of sit in a mode. We quite naturally flutter between them. And sometimes to become aware of that fluttering, and particularly the mode sequences that may be linked, for example, to things that we might be working on, like more eating disorder ways of coping, can be really valuable. So the first step, in a way, is to connect with a therapist and to build trust, and together to support kind of awareness building, really, of core schema, where they emerged from, how they link to the unmet need, how they show themselves, both in terms of the modes and in terms of the kind of core pain underneath that in the vulnerable child. And then what we tend to do is to work. I mean, the ultimate goal of schema therapy is to support individuals to get their primary needs met in adaptive ways. And so a lot of the time, what we're trying to do is to work with parts of the self that are getting in the way of that. So, for example, we may be working to use kind of a two chair type technique to get alongside the critic, to try to hear what it's got to say, to try to contain its messages, to try to, you know, sometimes we do really interesting imagery stuff where we shrink down the critic to try to reduce its impact. We may also work directly with the coping mode. We may do some work around trying to increase our familiarity with it. So one of the questions that I sometimes like to ask someone when they're in touch with a particular coping mode, let's just say an eating disorder coping mode, is to ask them, you know, what are you doing for so-and-so? Why do you need to be there right now? And what would it be like if you work less hard and if you enabled some sort of healthy adult to be more in the driving seat and to pick up some of the reins here? And so we kind of start a really gentle dialogue, really, between the different sides of the self. And all the time, the healthy adult's watching and the healthy adult's being involved in this process and is hopefully developing a kind of really healthy meta-awareness of both what the mode relationships are and, you know, to start to tune in a little bit more, to be less driven by the coping modes and to tune in a little bit more to the needs underneath, the ones that are housed in that more vulnerable side of the self.
I guess I could give a bit of an example of how, like, modes can get in the way, in a way. And the reason, like, I lent into schema, and I think I remember, like, feeling very vulnerable about, you know, what therapy should I do? You know, I'm a clinical psychologist. I shouldn't even be in this position. I should have psychologized myself out of this. Like, what was going on was I had an incredible critic, incredible. And he was, you know, and so a kind of traditional sort of pen and paper or cognitive type way in for me just was going to kind of fall down. Like, so that level of mode, and there wasn't, my healthy adult wasn't, needed a bit of moral support, basically. So there was no way that I was going to be able to make use of that stuff. So I think what's nice about schema is when you build that kind of awareness, it doesn't mean that you can't, down the line, use some of the other kinds of strategies and techniques. So actually, sometimes when you deliver schema therapy, you do sort of bring in cognitive and behavioural ideas. You can, and you, as long as it's sort of met by a healthy adult, you're kind of landing it at the right point in the journey. But I think it mainly reflects a lot where, you know, if you've got a critic, or if someone also is, so if you think about these different coping modes, sometimes people have more like an intellectualised type place, and I'm not good with all the names of what you call it, but a kind of place that keeps you sort of safe from feeling, because you're being so bright and brainy, but it doesn't allow you to connect. So you know with your heart and your soul, it's quite protective. So sometimes you can be delivering therapy, like a CBT type therapy or a kind of more sort of standard therapy, and feel as a clinician like you're ticking the boxes, and the person can be sort of either in an intellectualized mode or maybe a pleaser mode where they're nodding and ticking the boxes. But afterwards, you don't have a sense of, did that really touch that person? Like, did it really hit their sort of heart and soul? Like, is this really coming alive for them? Mm-hmm. And schema has more scope, more creativity, more space, I think, for you to clinically sort of check or collaboratively check out that things are really landing in a way that's helpful. And so I think for me, really experiencing therapy at a point where I really needed it as well, where I was really depleted. So I wasn't in a kind of resource, you know, I'm going to do therapy as a bit of a professional development, but it was kind of a point in time where it was important for me. I think the lessons in that are around how valuable the idea of modes are, and understanding kind of critic and coping modes. I think the other benefit of schema, like you said, Hannah, there is the ability to go deep, but there's the ability to go where you need to go as well, I think. There's still a framework there. So if deep isn't relevant to the person, you can lighten it and move into more sort of practical stuff. And I think for me, there was, maybe I've always felt a little bit like a misfit in clinical psychology, because I think there are people who do therapy and it works. Different things work for different people. But I've always been quite a feeler, quite sensitive, I did A-level art, so quite creative. And with schema, you have the space to connect in quite creative ways. You can bring modes alive. I think I always like role play probably a bit more than like the actual reality. So you can bring in drama, you can you can begin to understand the emotional sort of state in a way that felt so much more intuitive to me. So, and then just growing up and being older, reflecting on it, I'm like, well, actually, you know, when we're little and we learn to feel, we don't start by putting words on feelings and being really cognitive. We start with playing and drawing and painting and listening to music and stuff. And then the words come later. So why would it not be the same that when any of us are at our most depleted and, you know, everything feels a bit jumbled, you know, everything sort of for me was like a messy jigsaw on the floor and I wasn't quite sure where all the pieces were going to go and what the order was. But actually kind of having more of a free space where someone just got alongside and allowed that and then found gentle ways to be with you and help you make sense of that emotional sort of position to build back towards something concrete, find more words that kind of work. Like that order of things really was much more of a gentle way and much less critic activating.
Yeah, and Nikki, it's making me think as well about, you know, the concept of unmet needs as well, which underlies the whole model, is that a lot of the unmet needs that we focus on, you know, although relevant, we miss others, such as the need for play, as you're saying, you know, the need for moments of joy, the need for flexibility and creativity, and all of those are naturally woven into the ways in which we we are within a schema therapy relationship. It is, you know, so far from a kind of paper pencil type exercise. And like Nikki says, you know, cognitive behavioral ways of working can also be playful and valuable and get interwoven. But the kind of, you know, the energy, if you like, in a schema therapy is very much about, you know, to what degree are we connecting with the emotion and the unmet needs underneath that? And if we know we're moving in that direction, we know we're kind of where we should be, really.
I just was just thinking when, because one of my questions that I had for you was like, what's the difference maybe between schema therapy and CBT? And I think you laid it out so nicely in terms of, okay, I don't want this to make it sound like I'm like pooing on CBT, because I know that for some people it works really, really well. For me, didn't. But that doesn't mean it doesn't work for other people. But I agree with you in that it felt for me like a tick box exercise. And I think I was very good at being, it's going to sound bad, but because I've done a master's in eating disorders and worked in eating disorders, I kind of knew what I needed to say to kind of get through it. And that meant for me that I was, you know, I'm also the kind of person, I'm very, very well behaved. So if you tell me to do something, I will do it. And so you'd have, you know, your homework that you'd go home each week and do, and I'd do it. But we'd never sort of get underneath of like, okay, well, why can't you do this off your own back? Like, you know, when you then need to go and flourish and do your own thing, why can't you? Whereas the more emotion focused therapy that I've done, and like you said, with sort of the more expressive stuff and the more creative stuff, I also did A-level art, so I don't know whether that all adds up together or not. But it made me feel like I actually had to connect to myself. And it's really funny that you spoke about chair work, actually, because I literally did that this morning. And it initially I was like, this is horrific. I hate drama. I don't want to do this. This is awful. But it got so deep. And it got me thinking about, you know, the role of my eating disorder in a way that I've never really thought about before. And once you start to have those conversations and that back and forth, you almost, I know it made me realize what maybe I'm missing in like, you know, Hannah, what Hannah is missing in herself and what she's leaning into the eating disorder for, which, you know, like I said, CBT can work, but I never felt that from CBT. I felt like it was very rigid. And for me, with somebody with such a rigid mindset and a rigid eating disorder, I really needed to be creative and express myself in a way that like I've never been able to do before because I've had the boundaries of the eating disorder.
Yeah, it's interesting as well with eating disorders, isn't it? How sometimes that we can get so bound up in talking about the behaviours and talking about it at a sort of symptom level. But again, what schemotherapy is trying to do is to get underneath that. You know, behaviours are understood as being one aspect of a coping mode. But, you know, when we use chair work as well, we're not talking about those symptoms. We're not talking about the mode. We're talking from that perspective. And I think that shift in perspective is so powerful because it means that we bring all of us on board in that conversation. We think about the emotional impact that being in that place has, the behavioral impact, and we can invite other parts of the self, such as the more vulnerable self, to tell us what is it like being underneath all of that coping mode. You know, what does it feel like? What do you miss out on? So something so sort of rich and dynamic, I think, about keeping part selves alive, inviting parts of the self that maybe don't get much airtime because they're constantly being squashed down by, you know, an eating disorder coping mode, for example. And it's amazing what can come when you invite a part of the self that's pretty neglected, actually, to have more space and to have more airtime and to dare to connect on many levels. So as Nikki's saying, not just verbally, it can be the body can tell us a lot about what.
You ain't heard about Moto Casino? Moto has real Vegas slots. Any game you can find on the floor in Vegas, you can play it on Moto. I like my slots hot. Moto's free to play, like food stamps, in line at the grocery store, at a funeral, in traffic, keep your eyes on the road, hop on Moto Casino. Moto Casino got jackpots that are bigger than my belly. Moto, America's hottest free-to-play social casino.
Download the Moto Casino app today. Moto Casino is a social casino. Void where prohibited. No purchase necessary. Visit Moto.us for more details.
Moto Casino, America's social casino.
You're listening to a podcast right now. Driving, working out, walking the dog. If you're into podcasts, chances are you have something to say too. With RSS.com, starting your own podcast is free and easy. Upload an episode and we distribute it to Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Amazon Music, and more. Track your listeners, see where they're from, and start earning from ads just like this. If you've been thinking about starting a podcast, this is your sign. Start your new podcast for free today at RSS.com.
Part of the self may actually be experiencing, and so too can images. So there's a richness for enabling people to describe things in ways that are, you know, in keeping with the developmental age of the mode that they're speaking from. But also we're all different, aren't we? We all have different kind of ways of expressing things. And I think it's a lovely model for being able to really make the most of that, those opportunities, I think.
Yeah. I think something else that I really like that I mean, you've not said explicitly, but and then tell me if I'm wrong, I might be making an assumption, but it's almost, I think the thing I like is that, you know, eating disorders can be so black and white in that, like, this is good, this is bad. Mm. And initially, I think when you come into therapy, you think eating disorder bad, you know, real me good. And actually, it feels as almost as though through schema therapy, you sort of uncover all those different modes. And maybe right now your pie chart is like full on eating disorder with like a tiny little bit of these other modes. And actually it doesn't have to be necessarily that the eating disorder has to completely go. It might just be that you reframe it into, you know, that's like a protected mode or something. And then you can uncover as to, okay, why do we feel like we need so much protection? And actually, can we bring in these other parts of ourselves that are, like you said, currently not really getting much airtime, but could be really helpful? Because I found that, like, not explicitly the eating disorder, but sort of the characteristics and maybe parts of me that mean that the eating disorder exists, mm-hmm. they're actually not the worst thing in the world. You know, I'm a very determined person. Mm-hmm. I'm quite perfectionistic. I just like things to be a certain way. I'm very driven. And actually, I don't want to get rid of those parts of me. I want to keep them, mm-hmm. but I just maybe don't want them to be quite as loud. And then those other parts of me to be quite so suppressed.
Yeah. 100%, Hannah. I think it's some of the modes that are linked to eating disorder ways of being that are the very modes that have the energy that get people well in the end.
Yeah.
And, you know, the sort of eating disorder ways of being, you know, I sort of when you sort of track a mode developmentally, so you look at the time at which it developed, you look at what was going on at that time and why it needed to come online, why it needed to be there, you know, it's always really evident that they're really adaptive at the time of that they came into action, and that they're people's very best attempts to manage things. And it's really important to understand that frame and that kind of the evolution of the coping mode, in a sense. And then they can be almost like a, you know, from the perspective of a healthy adult, a kind of reconsideration, really, of which bits of this very powerful, energetic, driven mode do I want to really prize as being a valuable part of me, and which bit has enough downsides that actually I might want to leave or find other ways of being. So, you know, 100%, I think the whole concept of a coping mode, and we, you know, the idea that we are all most of the time in coping modes, you know, this is what we do. We don't walk around with our core pain. That's too much for anyone. But sometimes, you know, our coping modes can benefit from a little bit of tweaking here and there. So it very much moves away from this sort of, you know, absolutely right, that sort of dichotomy of good and bad is really, really unhelpful, not relevant, really.
I want to ask there, because you said about tweaking certain modes. So is it possible to create a completely new mode, or do you kind of have to stick with those modes that you kind of gained during that developmental period and then maybe embrace them, suppress them, or can you create completely new ones?
It's a really good question. So I think, because of the way in which, you know, we're, like I say, this is just a general construction of a self, it's not a sort of, they're not pathological, you know, it's not something to be got rid of, is that I think most of the time we are, it is more of a tweaking. I sometimes talk about the concepts of sort of dialing down some modes. So, you know, a perfectionist mode being an example of that, where, you know, to be sort of, you know, driven in the world and to like things to be a certain way, you know, if that's dialed up to 100%, that has a number of downsides. If it's dialed down to 70% and there's possible to have a conversation about what that might look like, then that frees things up. And I sometimes sort of talk about what we're trying to do is just get a little bit of wiggle room from those coping modes, because ultimately, the ultimate goal is for the healthy adult to be able to hear the needs of the vulnerable child. What do you need in that moment? And the difficulty is that if coping modes are turned up on full throttle, you can't hear what your vulnerable child is saying, because you're too busy sort of, you know, in a people pleaser mode, say, or too busy in an intellectualizer mode, that you've forgotten that you're actually exhausted, that you want a break, or you've forgotten that actually, you know, it was tough in the morning and you felt actually quite lonely at home. And it's that slightly dialing down so that there can be that greater connection with the unmet need and the emotional stuff that's underneath that. So I think it is more about tweaking, but it's not to say that, you know, with the concept of the healthy adult, it could be, you know, it can be more or less available to us. So, you know, I've had to work quite hard over the years to develop a healthy adult that has a compassionate tone to it, you know, that can speak gently and can guide me away from a critic, for example. Other healthy adults need to learn how to self-regulate, how to, you know, sort of take breaks, how to set different priorities. So there can be some learning that goes on, if you like, or some skills building. But ultimately, I think, you know, it's quietening that critic, which gives people a hard time, dialing down the reliance on coping modes so that there's greater connection between the sort of core needs that we all have underneath and our emotional self, and getting them met in healthy ways in the world.
I was going to say, I kind of think about, so although we talk about no pen and paper, I've got this, I've still got my mode map, and it's, but I kind of also think about it in terms of almost like when you first come in, or when I first sort of came in, my critic was really big, like, and had, you know, parts to it. And then my coping modes were also kind of quite dominant, and my healthy adult needed to be grown, visually, and the coping modes needed a bit of shrinking and sort of almost space. So all of those, and the critic needed to back right out. just shrink back. So they're kind of like, it's the quieting, it's how you can tap into all the senses. It's visually feeling that stuff is a bit more manageable, but like, and that there is breathing space to reach your vulnerable child. So then the vulnerable part might well be just completely sort of suffocated behind the coping mode. The coping mode didn't mean to suffocate it, but they've just been building up to try and cope with this massive critic over here. But it still happens, and so the healthy adult can't reach the vulnerable child. So I guess the therapy is also about, I almost feel like bringing some breathing holes in, or like allowing to reach its hand down and hold the vulnerable child up, and then get more and more, like Helen said, wiggle room space.
I wanted to ask, because I think something that's very prominent for me, and I don't know whether other people will be able to relate to this, but it almost feels like in society, those sort of, I don't want to say negative parts, because, you know, we've said we're not going to have that like dichotomous thinking, but the maybe more perfectionistic, that more critical voice, they often feel quite glorified, in the sense that if we think about, you know, kind of everyday life at the moment, it's New Year's resolution season, and you know, people are very critical of like, I have to have this New Year's resolution, like I've got to better myself. But it never feels as though, I don't know, I've never heard, well, I do more so nowadays, but it seems less common to be like, my New Year's resolution is to be more compassionate for myself, or to be more kind to myself. It's always kind of, you know, I'm gonna go on this diet, or like I'm gonna start doing this much exercise. And basically what I'm trying to say is, how did it feel to sort of move yourself from maybe quite a critical environment to actually developing more compassion and kindness for yourself? Because we do all talk about, you know, in society, like self-care and all of this, but without making this sound horrible, in my eye, and maybe this is just my perspective, but it's almost seen as weaker. And I think in society, it's seen as almost a weaker personality trait than like the strong-willed, like, you know, pushing through and keeping going. And I think that's what holds me back sometimes from allowing myself to be in those modes. It's because they're not seen as maybe as powerful, or, you know, kind of admired in society.
Mm-hmm. And I think one thing that I did in therapy, or thought about in therapy, was, and I don't know if it quite connects with this, but maybe we can make it connect somehow, but the idea of like live critics as well. So you have an internal critic, and the internal critic might well have started when you were quite little, so it could be messages you receive from parents, or like things they were modeling in front of you. So they might have been incredibly critical of themselves, and you picked that up as, okay, that's how it's meant to be, that's what you're meant to do. Or, you know, there could have been really difficult experiences directly, but I think also we have to navigate quite a confused society. I think from, you know, just from my, in terms of put my clinician head on, like the kind of messages that get put out there about appearance and social media, all of that stuff, it's quite hardcore to navigate all of that stuff, and to be able to work out where those messages are coming from, whether they're helpful or harmful. Like, they're packaged as healthy and helpful, but they're often kind of delivered in a very different way and received in a very different way if they come through a critic's filter. So I had to learn about when live critics were also reinforcing, or live critical, like critic-inducing environments were also sort of making it very hard to ignore my critics. So I think that almost like the systemic part of things came in there for me, if that makes sense. And that's where I think I needed my healthy adult to be quite hardcore and grow quite strong. And I needed my clinician, my therapist, to model healthy adults with me, join me, help me get really strong to make sense of all of that noise, because there wasn't just an internal critic, there was other stuff to navigate. And I think, yeah, so sometimes people need a lot more strength. So I've noticed that for people, so just translating that right into more of an eating disorder related scenario, we have environments that are more hard, you know, more difficult to navigate. So if you're an actress or an actor, if you're a model, if you're a pop star, like, it's going to be much harder to ignore some of that pressure. Like, that pressure is going to be really strong, so they're going to need incredible strength to sort of find their own ways of sticking two fingers up to that, or, you know, just to kind of think of, actually, what's the truth for me, what's right for me, how am I going to do this. Yeah, so I don't know if I've answered where you were going with it, Hannah, but I it takes thought to sort of catch that and have conversations about that and over the time and over the therapy to understand how that's landing, where that's coming from, like what mode also. So like maybe in the early stages it is really hard because it's just the critic kind of taking that information and amplifying it. So it's kind of just noting that to start with, but then yeah, in time building ways. But I found it really hard to build up compassion. I tell you, Brené Brown is someone I'm absolutely obsessed with now. And I think I did definitely remember having one phase of treatment where I just, my critic was really, like, I just couldn't tune it down. I couldn't find a way to not hear it. And so I just had one of her books. I think I just read it gently to myself. I used to open it at random points. And like, that was the best I could do at that point in time, to try not to. But it's, yeah, I don't know.
Moro Casino, American Social Casino.
Welcome to Moto Casino, where the excitement never ends, with thousands of the hottest free-to-play social casino games, fastest payouts, and the best promotions in the industry. No tricks or gimmicks. Owned and operated in the USA.
Moto Casino is a free-to-play social casino. No purchase necessary. 21 plus to play. Void where prohibited.
Sign up today for a generous welcome bonus.
Moto Casino, American Social Casino.
Download the Moto Casino app today.
You're listening to a podcast right now, driving, working out, walking the dog. If you're into podcasts, chances are you have something to say too. With RSS.com, starting your own podcast is free and easy. Upload an episode and we distribute it to Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Amazon Music, and more. Track your listeners, see where they're from, and start earning from ads just like this. If you've been thinking about starting a podcast, this is your sign. Start your new podcast for free today at RSS.com.
It's a hard process to sort of work out the modes, work out what you need, work out how to build your own, how they're built. So kind of having a bit of a helping hand in that is thoroughly recommended.
Yeah. The other thing I was just going to add a bit about critics is, and I think it can be really relevant in eating disorders, is that, you know, I think sometimes we think of the critic as a bit of a unitary thing, you know, that's critical. And all it really is a kind of a sort of an introductory. It's an internalization either of, you know, sort of societal messages. It can be cultural norms, but also, you know, in a very basic form, it's a kind of superego, isn't it? It's trying to keep us in check. And it's on a continuum through, you know, getting us up in the morning through to being extremely attacking, annihilatory. But it's also not always critical. And I think some internal voices are quite hard to capture the essence of, and it's quite important to do so, because they can be so automatic and sort of get under the skin somehow that they can be hard to hear. So you can also have an internal dialogue that's really guilt inducing. You know, really? Compassion? Do you really think that you deserve that? You know, shouldn't you be working harder? That kind of thing. Or just subtly invalidating, you know? Is that the case? You know, do you really feel that? Have we got that right? Maybe you need to think again on that one. So, you know, there's sort of different degrees of and different content types of these internal dialogues, and they have quite different origins and they have quite different effects. So, you know, recognizing when a voice is invalidating, sometimes it's hard to capture because it's more about tone than about content. But actually the effect it has is that sometimes people say, well, I don't have a critic. But it's like, no, but you do have the side of yourself that's basically second guessing everything you're thinking or feeling and making you feel really doubtful. And that is a tough, that's tough to be on the receiving end of. You know, and how we would work with a critic of a different variety is slightly different. So, you know, yeah, I just think there's something about trying to really listen really carefully to that inner voice and to try to get a sense of it together. Because remember, the individual is so used to hearing it, it can just feel automatic.
Yeah, I was going to say, I think that's a really interesting point in almost in terms of like the normalization of it all. You know, if that's been your norm and your go-to, then for somebody to say like, oh, let's explore your inner critic, you might be like, I don't have one. Like, yeah, that's, you know, and it's only going on in your head. So I think, yeah, that is quite a difficult concept in terms of, you know, like you just said about doubt there. Like, I don't think that I would have thought that me doubting myself was my inner critic, but actually, you know, it is because it's, you know, are you sure about that? Like, and I think that's one thing I've found recently is so hard in recovery is that kind of that doubt. You know, I think guilt for me always felt like quite an obvious one because it's guilting me. It's making me feel guilty about things, but doubt, like, oh, but are you hungry right now? And like, are you sure you need that? And that's one thing that's been really prominent for me is trying to determine what's like a pro recovery decision and what's a anti-recovery decision, I guess you could call it. And for, like, as an example, this weekend I was going to see a friend and going away for the whole weekend, and I literally had to sit on the floor of my bedroom and just like weigh up what was going on, because I was like, part of me was saying, you know, if you go then you might not kind of engage in your meal plan as much because you're out of your comfort zone and that will feel scary, so you should definitely stay home. But then the other part was like, but no, you should go because you want to see your friend and that will be really good for you to connect. And I was like, yeah, but now you're withdrawing if you don't go. And it was so like messy. And I think that's when it can get really overwhelming, when you've got all of those different voices going on and you actually have to spend so much time thinking, you know, what's actually honest right now and what's coming from a good place or a bad place. And sometimes you can't even answer that. You just kind of have to go with your gut as to be like,
yeah,
this is what I'm going to go with as to what I think is going to be the best decision.
That's such a lovely summary of listening to the more sort of needs-based side of us is all that noise, all the decisions, all the to-ing and fro-ing. What does my gut say? That's a really lovely example of cutting through the coping modes and listening to the core stuff.
Yeah. And I wanted to ask you also about your schema therapy school, because, you know, I'm sure people listening to this may be very interested in finding out more. So what sort of was the idea behind that? Why did you develop it? And what's the sort of goal behind the school?
Well, so I run Schema Therapy School with Yanis Paredes, who's a senior counselling psychologist. And we've both been really passionate about, we're schema therapists. That's what we do every day. We're also sort of supervisors. And we've always loved training. And I think our wish really was to train others, is to be involved in building a community, really, which is what Schema Therapy School has become. Build a little community of people who have a shared passion, and to really make our training sort of in keeping with the model, that it's experiential, it's lively, we bring ourselves to it, it's not an intellectual exercise, we put ourselves on the line. And as a result of that, you know, it generally feels like a privilege to me, sort of other therapists, to connect quite deeply, for people to talk about their own stuff, their own experiences, their own therapy journeys, as well as, you know, their own passion for the clinical work. You know, it's definitely not a training for the faint-hearted kind of thing. You know, there's a real expectation of throwing yourself in. But, you know, we've you know, really thoroughly enjoy offering our training. And yeah, like I said, I think we feel like we're building a little community of people interested in learning about schema therapy full in terms of the full accreditation training, but also people who, you know, want to learn a little bit more about, you know, a specific angle of schema therapy, like, you know, like schema therapy and eating disorders or schema therapy and trauma or, you know, whatever it is. So yeah, we've been going for quite a few years now, and, you know, really, really enjoying the journey of it.
Yeah. And Nikki, you mentioned it kind of really, it sounds like it contributed to your kind of role as a clinician overall, like maybe not just when you're giving schema therapy, but in general, like, do you feel like it's enhanced you as a clinician to be able to kind of provide more to your clients?
I think so. I think, well, so I, after, so I've done training with Helen in the NS as well, so I would massively recommend it as well. but I think it brought a depth, by both being on the receiving end. So I suppose in terms of my, I had therapy before I then started doing training in it as well. Mm-hmm. So, a kind of, yeah, that was the way it went. But so I think both have informed my practice. Mm-hmm. And it's hard to say, isn't it? Like I maybe like growing as a clinician over time as well, you get wiser. And I think there are, you know, great clinicians out there who haven't had to sort of navigate kind of more moments in their life because maybe they haven't had, like, you know, we're all human, aren't we? We have like a stacking of life events, and sometimes those life events hit us at a point in time where we just don't have the resources. Like, we might be more defeated mm-hmm. at that point, just need a bit more of a helping hand. So I guess it doesn't necessarily mean that, you know, if you haven't been through that kind of thing, that you don't have stuff to bring. But I do know that, yeah, like, there's been something very important for me about being on the receiving end, and then you know, it's kind of been a springboard into kind of knowing more about it touching my heart and soul, kind of, but being able to think about how to touch other people's hearts and make really making sure therapy resonates with people. I think that's what it's done for me now. It's whether I'm doing schema therapy and more formally or delivering, you know, treatment that's relevant, you know, in another way for the person I'm working with, I'm always mindful of, you know, how's this landing, and, you know, is this the right fit for them right now? How do we make it work? I think I often ask people at the end of sessions about kind of what's really resonated, what you're going to take away, and not in a homework way, but like, how are we going to make this come alive to you between now and next week?
Yeah, I think, you know, like I was kind of saying about the CBT, in that it works for some people, maybe not for others. I think it's very similar with when clinicians have been on their own journey, whether that is, you know, a therapy journey specifically or whatever. You know, we've all had ups and downs in life, but I completely agree with you in that I think, you know, whether it's going through an eating disorder or going through therapy, it just gives that other element of sort of understanding. And, you know, I've found when I have been working with therapists that it's just kind of helped them to understand how I'm feeling. But also I don't want to sit here and say that, you know, I'd never want to work with a therapist that hadn't gone through their own therapy or whatever. I just think it's that self-development piece, isn't it? And whether that's, you know, going to loads of CPD trainings or having therapy yourself, you know, and you all have to have supervision, so that's kind of a self-reflective thing anyway. I think developing those sort of skills really allows you to then give back to the people that you're working with.
Yeah, well, it's definitely part of our ethos at Schema Therapy School that we really sort of we obviously, it's from no benefit to enforce it, but we sort of strongly encourage that therapists, you know, launch into their own therapy for all the reasons you said, Hannah. You know, there's, it's an experiential person-based therapy, and it's really hard to do that without having, you know, put yourself into it as well. So yeah, support that idea entirely.
It's really nice to sort of say that out loud, because I think you can feel quite vulnerable as a clinician when you when you do need to lean into the kind of therapy. And I think we don't talk enough about the strengths that come out of it and the growth that comes out of it for people. And I think, I don't know whether that's about my own critic as well, like the kind of the shame of it really, and but kind of reclaiming that and saying, well, you know, there's so much learning and so much that I have powerfully taken away from that experience that has propelled me forward as a human and as a clinician.
Yeah.
Being more proud of that. I need to probably be a bit more proud.
Yeah. And I think that is, you've like knocked the nail on the head there in terms of like being proud of that self-development and that therapy, because I always see it as, that's why I'm so open on Full of Beans about, you know, my own eating disorder experience. If I can kind of come on here or go on and write a post about my eating disorder experience, somebody that might think, ooh, an eating disorder, you know, that's maybe something to be ashamed of, or there's a lot of stigmas attached to it, or, you know, it's something that we have to keep hush hush. And then they see me kind of, you know, sharing, I have an eating disorder and this is what's going on for me right now. I always think, I saw somebody put the other day on Instagram, it's like, I'm recovering loudly so that somebody else doesn't have to suffer silently.
Love that.
And I loved it so much because I was like, that's so true. And I've had so many people say to me, like, you know, is it actually positive for your recovery for you to do this? And I actually think it's really positive for me. Mm. But also I'm hopeful that it's helping so many others as well by me sort of sharing my experience and then being like, oh, maybe there isn't something to be ashamed of.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Well, thank you both so much. I have enjoyed that so much. I think that it really resonates with the work that I'm actually doing currently with myself. So it was really cool to kind of talk to you about that. I guess if people do want to learn more about schema therapy and about the work that you both do, where can they find you both?
They can certainly contact us at the Schema Therapy School. So we have a website. It's just www.schematherapyschool.co.uk. We're there. Our contact details are there. And we can sort of connect up definitely via there. So yeah, it'd be lovely if people want to get in touch.
I'll put that all in the show notes for people so that they don't have to scribble it down with their pen and paper now.
Lovely.
But yeah, thank you both so much. It's been really lovely to chat to
you. It's been a pleasure. Thank you, Hannah, for having us.
Absolute pleasure. Lovely.
Yeah.
Thank you.
If you enjoyed listening today, you won't want to miss next week's episode, so be sure to subscribe. Eating disorders are crippling illnesses, but with the right support, they can be recovered from. We really hope you enjoyed this episode, but if you require more support right now, please look into charities such as First Steps and Beat for support, or talk to someone you trust.
Moro Casino. American Social Casino.
Welcome to Moto Casino, where the excitement never ends, with thousands of the hottest free-to-play social casino games, fastest payouts, and the best promotions in the industry. No tricks or gimmicks. Owned and operated in the USA.
Moto Casino is a free-to-play social casino. No purchase necessary. 21 plus to play. Void where prohibited.
Sign up today for a generous welcome bonus.
Moto Casino. American Social Casino.
Download the Moto Casino app today.